What I want to show you is a model for thinking about technology and education. And let me tell you the history of this model. This goes back to the early 90s. And I was looking at schools across the entire range, but particularly in higher ed, getting into technology. And thinking, well, how do we do this well? How do we learn from those who have trod this path before us? And in particular, I took a look at what was happening then with companies. Now remember, this is early 90s, before the internet, okay, before the big internet boom. And I noticed that some companies had spent huge sums on technology. Not a little bit. We're talking huge sums. And they were doing awful. And some other companies who might have spent the same amount or a bit less were doing great. So what's the difference? Why were some companies building up a path to, you know, saying, here's how we use the technology to really increase our business, increase productivity, make what we do better, etc.? And other companies had spent the same money, or as I say, more money, were looking at, well, time to close shop, folks. What was going on? So I started looking at how they were using the technology. Clearly, it wasn't the number of dollars they were spending on the technology or who they were buying the technology from. And over the years, I developed a model based on the information I gathered together with some other models that existed at the time. And that model evolved, and the final version I finished in 2001. What we're going to be looking at today is a portion of that model. It's the portion that's most directly relevant to what we're talking about here. And that is to say, okay, one of the things that made a company successful or not successful was the level of technology usage. Now, in this context, in the handout you got inviting you to today's series of presentations, workshop, etc., in mailings, in our discussions, we keep talking about transformation. And transformation may sound like a cute PR word. It's like, ooh, sounds good. Transformation, yeah, let's transform. But it turns out that in the context of the model I'm telling you about, it actually has a very definite and concrete meaning. So let's see what that meaning is. As I said, one of the key features that I found was what level the companies were using technology at. And I found that there were these four levels that you could reasonably segment usage into. Substitution, augmentation, modification, redefinition. Words at this point. Let's put some meat on the bones. Okay, so these go from lowest level of usage to highest level of usage. So the first one is substitution. Substitution is the lowest level of usage. At this level, the tech is a direct tool substitute for a tool you were already using, but you don't introduce any functional changes. At this level, classic example is a word processor used like a typewriter. You used to be using typewriters, now you're using word processor. When I say like a typewriter, I mean like a typewriter. So you're typing along, you find that you made a mistake two words back and hit delete, just like you would have hit the whiteout button in the typewriters, okay? So you're not using cut and paste, you're not using spell checking, you're just using it as a fancy typewriter that comes with the screen. Now, companies that operated in terms of their use of technology at this level found that overall, productivity remained the same or even took a slight hit. Why? You can see the same. I mean, if I'm using the word processor like a typewriter, fine, I've just substituted one exactly for the other. But think about it this way. The typewriter is immediately there. You finish typing off a sheet of paper, you pull it out, you're done. With the word processor, you still have to go to the printer. That's already a loss of time vis-a-vis a direct use of the typewriter. Additionally, with the typewriter, you have maybe a couple of carbon sheets in there, unless you have one of the fanciest electrics, late models with memory, and they actually work. So you could run off more copies, but that was as many copies as you made. Okay? Maybe, for a few things, you might run off a menu or something like that. But with the word processor, it's easy to run off as many copies of the printout that you like. So now you're instead of spending the money on three sheets of paper, you're spending the money on 300 sheets of paper. And people who really weren't looking at whatever that document was you were typing up before now have to waste time, frankly, in many cases, looking at a piece of paper they had no interest in. So that's why you didn't just see flat productivity in these companies, you actually tend to see a slight dip in productivity if this was all they were doing with the technology. At the next level, you have what I call augmentation. And at augmentation, now you're using it to substitute directly for the technology, but you do introduce some functional improvement. So now you're using the word processor, but now you're using the word processor's built-in function. So now you do use cognitive, you don't go to it. You see the error. Instead of going back there and going to the shelves and pulling up Webster, you call up the spell checker and you just spell check the word and correct it that way. So at this level, now you've substituted the typewriter with a word processor, but you've actually made some functional improvements over the typewriter. Okay? At this level, if you looked at what happened with the companies that were using tech up to this level, you saw that your productivity either remained definitely flat or actually gave you a slight up. Okay? So the first one was flat or down, this one was flat or slight up. So, alright. So far, nothing dramatic was happening. The next level was where things started getting really interesting in terms of productivity and also associated phenomena like what percentage of the business market the companies were eventually taking over and so on. And that's modification. At the modification level, now, instead of just saying, well, we'll use those built-in features that make the tool a little bit better than the typewriter, for instance, that it replaced, then you say, well, let's start redesigning the task that is involved in using this tool. So let's say that the typewriter was being used to produce a report. Okay, so here we went from just using the word processor the same way, now we're using the built-in functions of the word processor, making it a little bit more efficient and finishing the report a little bit faster. But then I start saying, well look, reports have to be living documents that tell me something about the health of my company. So one thing I want to do is I want to have the latest numbers in there, so I can have a spreadsheet that has the latest numbers in there. And I can use graphing packages, so instead of just having a big column of numbers like I did in my old report, I can actually put the picture in. And now this is a substantial task redesign. Because in the old days, you might find that you needed a graph. First, it was too damn expensive to do for every report you prepare. It was made for the stockholders meeting and so on. And secondly, it wasn't part of your job. You shipped it off to the graphic design department, who will tell you, oh, you gave it to us too late, sorry, we can't do that, and it's going to cost so much in overtime, and you've got a lousy graphic, didn't look the way you wanted at the other end, etc. So the bottom line is, now you're not just saying we're enhancing what we're doing with the tool. We're actually thinking about redesigning the task. And you also think about redesigning the task. Once I have email here, you start saying, you know, do I need to print this out as paper? Do I need to kill a few trees every time I do this? Wouldn't it be more useful if I could get it more frequently to the people who really need to see it, and they can reply to me right away and ask me questions about it. So now email is allowing me to make this from a fixed document that really is something that's going to, for the most part, go into a file folder somewhere, just a living document that people can start talking about, that really allows you to redesign how that document is going to be used, how what role it plays. So companies that were using technology at this level were now seeing substantial productivity increases, not just an uptick. We're talking a significant increase.
Fine. So what happens at the next level? Well, the next level is redefinition. And redefinition is when you take a step further.
At the previous level, you were just saying, okay, I'm just redesigning this task. But this fundamental task, producing a report, still remains at its heart with key elements the same. When you go to redefinition, you start saying suddenly, is this a test that needs to be performed? Or is this the best way that what the reason for this performing this task is could be satisfied? If the question is getting information out to a team, is making reports the best way of doing it? Well, the days when you only had was the graphics team and the typewriter, yeah, it was because that was what you had. But now you're saying, well, no, hold on, let me use technology to rethink completely. So you say, you know what, a report, if it's going to be used, remember I said that at the email level, I'm producing this report and sending it out to the people so they can ask me questions. But really, in terms of modern organizational workflow, it's better if, instead of having one person produce the report, if it can be a document that a team looks at and shares as a way of day-to-day understanding what's happening with our operations, what's happening with our company, and obviously for all of you, what's happening in our school, what's happening with my students. Okay? So now you're not just saying I'm redesigning the task, I'm just completely changing the profile. It's no longer I'm going to produce a report for somebody to look at. It's we get out of the report mode altogether. Instead, we look at the information that would be compiled, and we use some type of work group software so that we're all collaborating on bringing this information together. We're all saying, wait, I see a different angle on this. And you know, before, I wasn't the person writing the report, so I never would have done this, but now that I'm participating in this as an overall informational process, I say, I too can call up a graph and show you better with this visualization tool what I see in this data. Okay? And you also say, well, you know, this data, aside from being a living document that the group develops and analyzes day to day as a whole, there are other people who have a right to see this data. If it's a corporation, it will typically be the stockholders, for instance. But for you, it's your community. And that doesn't just mean the community of teachers and students, it also means the community of parents and the broader community that you're immersed in. So you know, you start saying, well, this data is very good. And it would be great if we could put it on a website for people to look at and see, this is why we're doing this. And this is what's going on in this aspect of the educational process in this school and so on. But again, if you used to have to do that in the old days, off it went to the communications department, and 5 months down the road, you might have something or you might not, and God knows how long it would take to fix the typos and so on. Now you start saying, well, no, look, I integrate the software so I have a content management system that allows me to take this data and say, this piece, and this piece, push the button, boom, it's a page on the web. So these are the four levels. And as I said, at this level, which is the highest, companies were not just increasing productivity significantly, that was already happening here, they were literally just blowing their competitors out of the market. That's the difference you're looking at. In other words, when companies went into the redefinition level, that's where you saw the companies that just bloomed, and they were the ones already, when the internet came along, to just pounce on and really take over the market. And the ones that had stayed at these levels, well, we all waved them a fond goodbye as they vanished into the sunset. So now here's why I said that transformation is just not just a cute PR word. It actually refers to something very concrete in terms of this model. It refers to these two levels of software usage, as opposed to these two levels where it says enhancement at the bottom. So the bottom line is that you want to be, if you're a company, as we're going to see for a variety of reasons, an educational institution operating, using your technology at this level. Now, I want to emphasize that these enhancement levels aren't evil. Okay, there's nothing wrong with these levels. But you should view them as transitional levels. In other words, these are levels that you may have to go through. You may have to go through a level where you're training your clerical staff and they start using the word processor just as a typewriter. And that's fine, provided you understand it as a transitional level. If you think that it's okay to stick there, then you've got to think. You've got to really think. And I'm going to emphasize that these transitional levels mean transitional levels measured on the scale of months at most. You don't have much more time. If you say it'll take a couple of years to get there, you are in deep trouble. Not just because of the absolute time scale of competition and so on, that's a separate issue. But because once you start talking about these transitional levels at an institutional level, institutional structures set in, and suddenly people start setting in here and saying, I've done it this way for the past X years, why should I change that? So it's very important. As I say, absolutely, you say, well, look, I do need to go through this because it's an important stage in the development of my use of technology. But it's equally important that you view it as a transitional stage and a short, measured on the scale of months, transitional stage. The example I've given you here come from, obviously, you know, the corporate world, although, as I point out, this could apply equally well to the world of education. But I've also used this model throughout in education. In fact, the model was developed for education, even though I drew on the experience of the corporate world. Let me give you one example here, though, that's related to what Jim showed you earlier. You all saw that site, readbrain.com, that allows you to access Shakespeare and everything. Okay, let's do a quick conceptual example of how you go up this ladder using a tool like that. If all you're doing is reading the books online, or worse, printing them out on paper, you're at this level. If you're just reading them online, you're probably at the break-even. Yeah, you're not spending the money on the book, but it's a little slower to just read text on a screen than it is to read paper on a page. And if you're printing it out, it costs you more money to print out the book than it would to just go ahead and buy the art and Shakespeare and say. So that's where you're at. Now, if you say, well, I'm going to take this text, but now I'm going to start throwing in things. Well, for instance, students are reading Shakespeare. Shakespeare has a lot of vocabulary that students aren't familiar with. So now I'm tying this in with items such as online dictionaries, online thesaurus, so they can start seeing what the words mean. Connect this with online resources in terms of history and so on. Then suddenly you've got something that's operating at this time. So far, you're just in the enhancement level. But now start integrating other aspects into how you're using that text. So now instead of just having each student read the text on their own, you start looking at ways that the students can talk to each other about their experience of reading the text as they're reading the text. In fact, instant messaging provides some interesting ways for students to communicate on multiple levels, not just with text, but also with sound, also with graphics. So now you can start saying, well, let the students explore the realm of what resources they could bring in, share, communicate about, that allow them to enhance their understanding of the text, enhance others' understanding of the text, and really start constructing something that goes beyond the three things they read in the Cliff's Notes. Okay? Jim was talking about students that do just fine without ever having read the book. I'm always horrified by that. So everybody's wasting their time. We're all just playing a little charade where the students will get maybe cocktail party knowledge about what the book is about, but not really understand, read what the book is about. So if instead of saying that, you say, no, it's not something you're going to write a report, stand in front of the class, and parrot back the three things you learned from Cliff's Notes, but it's something that you have to start constructing, understanding about. Say you're using a tool like Noteshare to construct notebooks that focus on specific aspects of the Shakespeare. Right? Then you start looking at this qualification, because now you're starting to change how the student interacts with Shakespeare in ways that you didn't do in the classroom before. And finally, you take the step that to me is one of the most dangerous. One of the things that I find horrifying about how, unfortunately, literature is taught far too often is not only do the students not get any enjoyment out of that, and that to me should be a, frankly, paramount consideration, but also they don't learn to do much with it. Think about it this way. Students will learn to read poetry, so they learn this is the standard sonnet form. You can break it down into syllables and look at the rhyme scheme, all of that. That's a mechanical function. The question is, wouldn't it be nice if we had students who could appropriate the language of poetry to express themselves? Now people say, oh, they don't care about it. Oh, why? Why do you think rap sells so well? Rap is interesting. Because, in fact, it is picking up on things that lie at the heart of poetry and using them to communicate about things that, in many cases, students care about or at least they're interested in. Wouldn't it be great if we gave them the tools for getting into the heart of the literature? That's when you start looking here at redefinition. That's when you start looking at things such as, let's go back to Shakespeare. You look at something like the structure of Richard II. And you start saying, can I use tools to allow students to visualize the dual structure of Richard II, with Richard going down throughout the play, Bolingbroke going up throughout the play, the crossover at a certain point, how that correlates to the language that Shakespeare has each of the characters use and so on. Now we're beyond this level. That goes beyond students sharing still relatively traditional ways of relating to the play. Now we're getting to ways of thinking about the play that get at the heart of, can you understand the mechanics at such a deep level that you're not going to be necessarily Shakespeare, but you can appropriate for your own expressive use many of the same mechanics that Shakespeare uses in this play. So that's what you'd be looking at a redefinition level in your classroom. I've given you a model with a certain set of levels. Now let me tell you a little bit more about why.
Friedman talks in general terms
about competition between the U.S. and the rest of the world, how competitive the U.S. is vis-a-vis China, India, and so on. And that's one aspect of things. And we're going to put a little bit more of a quantitative base on. But I'm also going to argue that there's also aspects that don't involve competing with other countries. Let's say we want to change how we're doing things for reasons of internal fairness within the United States, even if India, China, and the rest of the world did this. How many of you are familiar with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD? The OECD, as its name indicates, economic cooperation, has a particularly key focus point. They're interested in saying, what is it that countries need to do to be competitive in today's world? Most of the participants in the OECD programs are countries from the developed world. There are, however, some participants from the developing world in different programs. So it's not uniform. Some countries participate in some programs, but not others. In particular, what we're looking at today is a set of assessments that's managed by the OECD and has been since the year 2000. That's called PISA. And PISA is a series of, you could call them standardized tests, but they're much more than that. What the PISA assessments are looking at is how are 15-year-olds prepared to assume different levels of jobs? What does their education mean in terms of their capacity to perform jobs? Perform is the key word here. This isn't UNESCO. There are other issues that have to do with general culture and so on, and the OECD is going to tell you, that's beautiful, that's wonderful. We're not interested in that. They're interested in, if this kid went out and got a job, with this level of performance on the PISA assessments, what kind of job did they aspire to receive? There are four categories in the current one. This is from the 2003 version of PISA. And I'm just going to be using three of the four categories, reading, mathematics, and science. There's a fourth category, which is generalized problem solving, which is a fascinating one to look at unto itself, but we don't need it for what we're talking about today, so I'll save it for another time. These are also very different from any standardized test you ever looked at. These emphasize, I keep coming back to, performance. What can the student do? What can that 15-year-old do? They don't care. If they took algebra 1, followed by algebra 2, followed by algebra 3, let's test and memorize all the factoids that the kid memorized. That's not it. It's more about the lines of what mathematical tasks that would be needed for this type of job can the kid perform. They're also much more sophisticated in as much as the analysis includes things such as levels of wrongness, patterns of wrongness in answers. They also require much more innovation by students. They require much more of the student not just sitting down and looking at type problems. These are not type problems. These are genuine questions that a student will have to think about, design approaches for, and so on. You basically could not coach students to PISA. You train, you try, whereas you can coach students, say, for the SAT. So PISA 2003, I'm using those results for today's discussion. Looks at these, a number comes out for each country in terms of the average performance for 15-year-olds in that country, although, again, you get much more on the average, you get the breakdown by socioeconomic levels, schools, and so on. But you get those numbers, and typically when these numbers hit the press goes, eek! The U.S. is 2 points below France! All our jobs are going to go to France! No, hold on, that's not how you read these numbers. If you look in detail at what the data tells you, there are categories of performance. And within those categories, all the countries in that category, if you look at it, are performing pretty much the same. So what I've done, to save you the trouble of having to go through and crunch the data, is I've done the analysis to figure out what the categories are of the countries that participated in PISA 2003, and found that rather than looking at exact numbers, which don't tell you as much of a story, let's look at what the groupings are. The United States is here, right, below Switzerland. Okay. So in this group, which is average, you'll notice my labels denote a certain lack of enthusiasm, and I'll get back to that in a second. You have most of Europe and the United States. So France, Germany, Iceland, Poland, the United States are all doing pretty much the same as far as educational results go, as far as the jobs that those 15-year-olds could aspire to based upon their education that they received. There is a group of countries that is definitely doing better than this average. And it's an interesting group because it includes most of the Commonwealth. Okay? The big Commonwealth countries. The United Kingdom is not in PISA 2003 because of the technical reporting issue with how they reported their results. But if you include their results, they'd also be in this group. Okay? So let's say it's Commonwealth countries. Okay, that's interesting. Take a look at Commonwealth countries, see what they're doing. You might find some interesting ideas from there. There's a second group, which is Finland and Liechtenstein. Both of them have gone through significant educational reforms recently. Again, interesting to look at these two, although I will, in terms of what they do with their educational reform movements, kind of get ideas from them. I will caution you that Liechtenstein is very small. Okay? So the total number of students in Liechtenstein is about the same as one district in the United States. So it's very easy for Liechtenstein to swing its results. But nonetheless, some interesting lessons there. And the last group is Japan and Korea. Also some interesting things there. And I will point out that Japan and Korea are among the most wired countries in the world in terms of both use of cell phones and also use of high-speed internet connections. And there are some interesting things developing there as well, all worthwhile looking at. But I'll just point out that this group is just better than average. I didn't put that, wow, the group to emulate, these are the capable. We're going to see why. Just look at the rest of the world. We have below average these four countries, Europe and former Soviet bloc. And then you have some countries that are substantially below average, and you have two groups there. There's a high group, which has countries like Thailand, Turkey, Uruguay, and then there's a low group, which has countries like Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, and Tunisia. One thing I'll point out is that the countries that are here know them, and they don't like them. How many people here are familiar with the one laptop per child, also known as $100 laptop? So the $100 laptop is a plan to provide a laptop for about $100 to every child in the country that subscribes to the program. All the countries that are participating in the program are in this group, and they don't want to be in that group. And they have analyzed it and said, yes, our way out of this group is via that technology, which you haven't made today. They don't. They're going to spend the precious dollars that they have. They don't have a lot of money to spare, but they're still going to spend it on acquiring that technology. These countries have realized that they need the technology to move ahead.
I said that the labels were somewhat unenthusiastic.
And you'll see why. I want to say, let's think of the PISA numbers in terms of a model for society. If your model for society is everybody is stuck in horrible low-level jobs, well, then you don't need a lot of education, but I don't think anybody does. Let me propose the following model to have a basis for comparison. The model is the following. You have 50% of your population that you want to have the option based on the educational level that they attain to either go to college, own their own shop if they want to be in the trades, for instance, become somebody in the technical sector that has the capacity to rise through the ranks of their profession, get a service level job where again they can rise through it and it's a gratifying job where they have a certain amount of self-determination. So that's for 50% of your population. The remaining 50% you break down into two brackets. 25% of your population gets the next level. So these are the technical jobs that are good, but you're pretty much going to be following somebody else's directives all the time. They're the service sector jobs that are good, but again, somebody else is going to be setting the parameters for your job. And the remaining 25% gets the rest of the job. Now, you'll agree with me, that's not a terribly ambitious picture for society. I'd hope we could do better than that. Well, let's use it as a parameter for comparison. Okay, we can take the OECD scores and say, getting to that level at 50, 25, 25 is 100. At 0 is the lowest level. What's the lowest level? The OECD says, well, there are levels below which we measure, but at that point, their population doesn't produce anything anybody wants. At most, they'll be producing a large-scale commodity like oil. And then your population doesn't matter because you see you ship in everything, the engineers, the machinery, and so on, and your population just gets to sit on the sidelines and basically lead very, very unhappy lives. So that you definitely don't want to be there. And unfortunately, there are some countries there, although none of the OECD participant countries are. All right. So here's where we're looking at. This is the above average group, Commonwealth, Japan, Korea, etc. This is the average group where the US and most of Europe is. This is the somewhat below average group, and then these were the substantially below levels. Notice that even this group, the above average, now you know why my labels were more enthusiastic, is not here. 100. And the group that the U.S. is in the 60s. That means roughly a C, not even a gentleman C, just a plain vanilla C. So that means that what you want to do is, if you want to put this in letter grade terms, you need to get from a C to an A. In statistical terms, this is two sigma, two standard deviations that you need to move to get from here to here. Now, that means that you can't change things just a little bit. You need something that introduces this type of two letter grades, two sigma, this type of substantiation. All right.
We've done a lot of research in education. Tons of research on what type of things improve performance.
Bloom, in 1984, published a paper, an educational researcher, collating huge amounts of work, and showing that you get exactly this type of shape of two letter grades, two sigma, for every student. Very important. That doesn't mean, hey, I'm going to get my average by having my super student become super, super, 2%. No, no, no. Everybody has to move two letter grades, two sigma, four. No cheating. Okay? What Bloom found is that you can get that result for every student. I keep emphasizing that every student. You'll say, oh, I have to, no. Sorry. But Bloom's research is very clear. You can do it for every student if you provide every student with one-to-one experience to them. Great. Only one problem. Two problems. One, expense. I've done back of the envelope calculations to see how cheaply you could do this. The cheapest you could do this by increasing the amount spent per student in the first year by 3 to 4 times, and for a variety of reasons, the cost increases for a while after that. I don't think you're going to get that. I don't think you're going to get that type of a tax increase in your district. But even if you could, there's not a problem. We don't have enough experience to use. When you hear the homeschooling community tell you, well, this is what we're doing, it's just what Bloom said. No. Hold on, guys. For a few, very few, precious few, very lucky homeschool students, they may indeed have parents who are, in fact, experienced teachers. But I can guarantee you that 99.999% of homeschool kids out there do not have experienced teachers. They just have tutors, but that doesn't get you this. All right.
What else can we do? Also in 1984, Bloom and Wahlberg both published material
looking at the effect of other selected variables on student achievement. And this is what they found. Notice that the only one that gives you that 2 sigma is that experience tutorial instruction. Everything else is quite a bit below that. I'll also mention that these don't add up together. You can't just say, oh, well, it's simple. I'll just put, let's add feedback-corrected mastery learning, and let's put some cooperative learning, and let's put some graded homework, and all those together, and I get 2.6. Hey, looks good. No, it doesn't add up. Bloom and Wahlberg have rules of thumb for what adds up and what doesn't. I have a very simple rule of thumb that's usually when you add up several of these things, you generally get the maximum value of one, assuming you're doing everything correctly, plus a little bit, itty-bitty little bit, from the others. So that doesn't work. In fact, in some cases, you can have misinteractions. For instance, if you include time on task, classroom participation, but also increase graded homework by a huge amount, suddenly, guess what? There are only so many hours in the day, your students are overworked, your results plummet. Because even though you combine things that individually could have done a good job, the combination is leaking.
So what does give you 2 sigma?
Computer use gives you somewhere between 0.4 to 2 sigma. So, go back to that first graph I showed you with the 4 levels of use of technology. If you stay at the lowest level and you don't do anything else to hurt things, you should be seeing, just because of the enhancement via technology of your regular classroom activities, you should be seeing around 0.4 sigma, which means that it's at least as effective as remedial tutoring. That's at the lowest. That's if you're doing nothing else. Remember, I told you don't want to stick there, right? But if you go all the way up to the highest levels, you get a measured, reproducible, two-sigma improvement. Two level grades. Your C students become A students. Your B students become B students. Your failure students become C students. What Hank showed you is the latest generation in terms of tools for teaching mathematics. The two sigma result, the first two sigma result of this kind that was measured about a little over a decade ago using a program called StatLabor. And that program is two generations behind what Pam showed. All the tools, in fact, we're showing you are well ahead of when people started getting two sigma results from introducing technology in the classroom. Obviously, you have to do things well, hence the model you're looking for. Okay, you can't just say, I'll just throw technology and I'll get two sigma. But if you do things right, if you use the type of tools that give you the potential to reach those results, and you use them well, you start thinking in the same way that I showed you about thinking about the Shakespeare, then you can see two sigma. And that's how you can get ahead
of where you're at right now and where you need to be according to the OECD results. Now, some tools have greater potential than others.
For today, I'm just going to highlight four primary technological avenues that we know have the potential to give you that transformative type of result, that we know have the potential to give you that true sigma that you're looking for. First one is visualization and simulation. This is a question of how your brain works. We are visual animals. We're animals are hardwired for visual stimulus. If you can put to any concept a visual correlate, even those people who say they're not visual learners, even non-visual learners, still get a huge improvement for it, particularly when you're looking at abstract concepts, particularly when you're looking at hard to get your mind around concepts. And even concepts such as you're looking at history. Okay? How many of you here have looked at a book like The Timetables of History? Even that very simple representation already starts giving you an aha type of picture of history that you never get from just reading a history book. What we can do with technological tools in terms of visualizing historical flow is much, much more advanced than that. IBM, for instance, developed some amazing free tools. Free, just go download them, that allow you to look at the flow of events through history. So visualization is very important in getting your mind around these concepts. And the partner of visualization is simulation. When you can ask all those what ifs, again, I'm going to be showing you a what if tool over lunch. It's got that logo that you all have on the laptops. It's on the image that I'll show you with every machine. And allows the student not just to take your word for something, but ask, what if? What if I have a neighborhood and the parameters for, say, racial integration change in that neighborhood? What does the picture look like over time? How do illnesses propagate through a population? How do ants find their way? Rather than saying, well, textbook says this, well, that's useless. They're not going to be able to do anything with that other than forget it once they left the textbook behind. They can actually experiment with these ideas. And so simulation is one of those things that also gives you a huge bang for the buck. And again, it's what Pat was showing you with simulate that front, and you'll get a kid who really understands graphs. Second aspect is social computing. Social computing refers to the aspect that when you have people talking to each other, you get much more than just, well, A is talking to B, B is talking to C, so they share ideas. That's nice. But social computing applications are all those applications that allow people to have the interactions come to mean much more than just, well, you got what I have, and I got what you have. Here's my simple example. You got flour. You got eggs. You got chocolate. We'll assume that everything else, butter, water, etc., is available. If I connect the three of you, sure, now you can make an omelet, you can make a nice little cup of chocolate, and so on. But in addition to that, you can also not just make what everybody else was making, but because of the interaction, now you can make chocolate cake, which none of you could make before. Social software applications, social computing applications, are those applications that allow you to make cake. Now let me put some numbers. Again, I really like to say, okay, I'm not just talking about this. Let's look at the data. Let's look at what models for innovation and organizations have to say about this data. I took the data that exists on different districts in the state of Maine, looked at schools at K-12, and some models on that have been developed over the past roughly 30 years of propagation of innovation through organizations, and I asked the question. Suppose we're using the type of tool that Pam showed. Now assume every district is using a somewhat different set of tools, and they're using it in somewhat different ways. They're not just all marching lockstep. Diversity is part of the beauty of it. Okay, so each of them is making use of different tools and making somewhat different use of the tools that they have. All right. Suppose that now you have them talking to each other. Clearly, they all gain directly the information that the others have already about these tools, but how much more of a performance gain of a score gain, so to speak, could you expect from connecting schools together? Here are the numbers I got. If you get 18 schools, that means teachers and students, by the way, talking to each other, sharing their experiences about using tools like PEMS, you effectively double the impact. So say that Parablet was good, you know, the tool was good, so it was giving at least a, say, one sigma advantage in each school it was being used in. Now you get two sigma because you've got people talking to each other because of the particular enhancement above and beyond the use of the tool that you get from social community. You don't have 18 schools to talk about. You only got 10 schools to talk with each other. Fine, still do it. You're getting an 80% improvement at that point. You're in a very small district, and for whatever reason, you don't want to go outside the district boundary. I know why you wouldn't want to go outside, but let's assume for a second that you do. No. Okay. Four schools still gives you a 50% improvement. One of the beauties of social computing is how much bang for the buck you get in terms of having people talk to each other. This whole story. 15,000 years ago, people were painting on the walls in the cave at Lascaux. If you go to Lascaux, it's not just, here's a painting of a person, here's a painting of an animal. There's sequence in the paintings. They're telling a story. It's like a comic. Okay, so you see, person is scared of feline animal, person kills, person is killed, person runs away. The whole thing tells a story of fear, hunts, and so on. And you have to remember, right now we're just seeing the pictures, but from everything that makes sense, everything we know about culture and so on, it's very likely you have people going along, telling stories, performing things in front of things. So it was not just the image in the sequence, it was also voice, sound, music, light probably, etc. But okay, that was 15,000 years ago. Question, why is it that we do such a poor job in education of harnessing a 15,000-year-old resource, which is the resource of bringing all the different wonderful tools that we have, voice, image, text, sound, to tell stories? That's this whole story. It's simply saying, let's just jump ahead. The digital milieu can integrate all these different aspects. Let's pull them all together. Okay, and again, I keep talking about no share, for instance, how I like to do this. Let's pull this all together so that we tap into the storytelling capacity. And by the way, it isn't just for language arts. Mathematics, for instance, is one of the places where you get the most benefit from using digital storytelling. Last one, one of my pet favorites, educational gaming. So 15,000 years ago, let's go. You go to the Pacific Southwest. Depending on where you are, somewhere between 8,000 to 5,000 years ago, you dig and you find that people had these weird vertebrae. They're not just that they were left around after they ate the buffalo or whatever it was. These have been sanded, and they also have a pattern of wing. They're called astrogales. You know what astrogales are? Primitive dice. People were playing games. We know this. They're probably playing games for a while. This is about the earliest data we have. There's also some data coming from Africa on Mancala, although that's a little more controversial. But at least 5 to 8,000 years ago, people were playing gambling-based games. These were actually more like coins. Initially, they were head or tail, then you had four-sided ones. So more like four-sided dice. But games have been an essential way of dealing with the world, thinking about the world, getting knowledge about the world, for at least, let's say, 5 to 8,000 years. And by the way, these are, I'm talking about games. I'm not talking about play. Play is much older. Animals play. Okay? Only humans have games. So the structure of games is something that you can tap into to have knowledge about the world, create knowledge about the world, explore the world. Again, let's use that. Those of you who read James Baldi's book, for instance, know that there's been a lot of work recently done on what you can get out cognitively from games, and it's amazing. And you can get huge mileage out of games. You see, for instance, people in higher ed are now more and more developing for things like economics, for the social sciences, they're using games. But the field is right now expanding, and it's a wonderful resource to be. For the rest of today, we're going to be looking at lunch at some examples of these. And then after lunch, you're going to actually be working with Noteshare, but so you can get a taste. All right. And with that, I believe that we are ready to go to lunch.